So I'm really glad that I got to be here tonight. When I got the call or the email, I guess, asking to come here, I was like, great, I would love to. And then I realized the topic was suicide, and I was like, awesome, great. But I think it is really something that's very important for all of us to know how to dialogue about. That's a word that we use a lot, dialogue. But it's one of those things where everyone really is affected in some way over the course of their life by suicide. It's something that is profoundly misunderstood by a lot of people generationally. It makes a big difference depending upon who you talk to, if their age. If they are older, there's going to be a very different understanding of suicide than, let's say, somebody who's in their 50s, than, say, someone who's in their 20s. And it's very hard within certain Catholic circles as well to discuss this, because the reality is that to take a life is a sin. We all know this, right? We know this is a very true thing. But those who choose to take their life are not necessarily doing so free of will. We know about mental illness. We know that it is very prevalent within society. But when we really start looking at the facts and start breaking down exactly how many people are affected by mental illness, we don't have a good grasp of this at all. And so keep that in your mindset. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. I'm from Atlanta. I grew up here. I've got siblings, and they're all in the Atlanta area, except for a baby brother who's up in Boston, Massachusetts. He's a medical doctor in emergency medicine. Very Catholic family growing up, always at Mass, and very faith-filled family. We didn't talk about the serious stuff, though, in our family growing up. Like, you just didn't talk about those things. And I remember major tragedies and even seeing them. I remember actually watching the Challenger explode. If you're in the lower 20s, you may not know what I'm talking about. But this was when one of NASA's shuttles exploded during launch. And once upon a time, people used to take great interest in space exploration. And so that would be something that lots and lots of children were watching at the time, myself included. We saw it, the TV got turned off, and the subject got changed instantly. That idea of talking about death, that idea of talking about when things go wrong, did not happen. And I know that my family is not unique in that regard. It's just not something that we don't like to talk about, the painful stuff. It's something that we try to avoid at all costs. And sometimes, unfortunately, we utilize religion to kind of keep us at bay from really talking or diving in on some of these issues. Pius X was known as the Pope of the Eucharist. But he's also the one who said that those who take their life should not be able to receive the Christian burial. And this was a belief for a very long period of time. We also have to keep in mind, though, the understanding or the psychological understanding behind suicide was profoundly misunderstood at that point in time. And in fact, there's a great deal of psychology that really still has not been explored within the church. And that's something that is being discussed by many theologians as well, that convergence of psychology and theology. It doesn't always seem to work as well. You have to pull in a whole big dose of anthropology as well to really come to better understanding of it. But to be more human, to be more loving, to be more pastoral and more compassionate to our brothers and sisters, it requires us to stretch our mind a little bit and come to an understanding of how does mental illness affect people? And when someone chooses to take their own life, what does that actually mean for them? What does that mean for us as well? One of those great misconceptions that people have is that this is just depression that ends up doing this. And it's not just depression ever. There are so many different causes of suicide, and I'm going to go into some of those, but there's also so many pharmaceuticals that we take today with the adverse side effects that people don't understand that are mood swings and sometimes suicidal tendencies. Now, these include things that we take like antihistamines so that we can breathe during the pollen season. But they can affect our bodies in a way that we're unaware of. And suddenly a happy person who just got really clogged up and congested suddenly is having thoughts that have changed them completely, changed their personality, changed how they approach life, just because they wanted to be able to breathe. And so that understanding and that necessity to be compassionate to those who are affected by these things is absolutely imperative. One in every five adults in America experience a mental illness themselves. One in 25, 10 million adults in America live with some type of a serious mental illness. One half of all chronic mental illness begins by the age of 14, three quarters by the age of 24. This is kind of very alarming, at least when you think of the fact that it's 1 in 5. Now, mental illness in some regard in terms of, it could be something as simple as just basic seasonal depression. Every seminarian that goes up to Chicago, I always tell them, like, you need to buy a seasonal affective lamp. You need one of those happy lamps, and you need to sit there in front of it reading your Office of Readings every morning. It is as important as your prayer. Why? Because you don't see the sun for like 4 months and your vitamin D is depleted and you hate life. How are you expected to love God when you don't want to even get out of bed? And so it's one of those things that can be as basic as it is, and it can be as much as anxiety. Lots of people struggle with anxiety. And a lot of people who don't have anxiety very much misunderstand what anxiety truly is. Anxiety can be something as much as simple nervousness and bodily tics, where someone picks at their nails or constantly fidgets in some way, bouncing that leg. This can also be a sign of some other type of thing going on within them. But that anxiety for many people is that constant feeling that something bad is about to happen. And it's looming over them at all points in time. And they are always scared that things are going to totally fall apart. And to imagine going through life, trying to sustain that day in and day out. You throw a healthy dose of depression on top of some anxiety, and someone's dealing with a great amount of struggle in their lives. I speak from personally, this is something I've struggled with since I was probably in about 8th grade myself. And it always kind of had its peaks and troughs. There are times in my life where I was so busy I didn't realize that I was struggling with these things. And then there were other times in my life where it became very apparent what was going on. One of the greatest times was most recently. I found myself in a priesthood assignment where it wasn't life-giving anymore. The baptisms had gone away. I wasn't doing weddings anymore. The things that make a celibate life as a priest very fruitful and happy were gone. And I was a very sad person. Not just sad, but like empty feeling. And it was probably one of the hardest times within my own life. Now, I can say that personally, I've never struggled with the idea of a suicidal ideology, personally. But I would say that there are many people who do that you would have no idea that they do. It's one of those things that casually gets brought up to priests, oddly enough, that people get comfortable once they talk to a priest for a while. And they'll share things, like they've got a plan maybe, or that they've thought about it before. Now, they always want you to promise that you won't ever say anything. But I need to let you all know that's not a promise that you can keep. That's not a promise you should keep. And it's not a promise that you can keep in any possible way, because that means that someone's having a great struggle. And you need to respond to that struggle. It may be talking to their parents. It may be, who knows how it's going to go. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But there are so many resources that are out there that we have the ability to contact so that we can facilitate something that's going to help that person be healed. And they need to feel safe, and they need to not feel like you've hijacked their life. If they're thinking about this, they already feel like they have no control within their own life. And so we have to be extra loving in those times to let them know that they are valued by all of us and that you care enough to take that interest in that person. It's this constant validation that I think is required. And the reason that we have to respond so strictly or so dramatically to that is because you don't know how that's going to play out in any way. It's a scary thing. It's one of those situations that when you find out, you ask right away, are you willing to talk to somebody about this? Myself as a priest, I've got about 6 therapists in the Atlanta area, depending upon what area of the metro Atlanta region they live in, that I can call and say, I've got somebody who I really need you to talk to. Are you willing to talk to them for me? And all of them are always happy to do so because they realize the severity of the situation at the time. Sometimes people are scared about other little things, like they don't want to go talk to somebody because they don't have any money, or they don't have insurance, or they just are poor, because let's face it, most of us are. I've got student loans too. I get it. And so maybe they don't want to go and seek help. But I can't think of any mental health professionals that I know that won't work on a sliding scale if you're poor. You're always willing to get therapy. And I want to say to anybody in here who's ever thought about getting therapy, do it. It is like the best investment you will make in any portion of your life. And if you aren't buying in on psychology at all, you really should give it a shot. There's a reason you're closed off to the idea of psychology, and you're proving right there that you need therapy. And so just be aware of that. The causes of mental illness are prevalent in so many different ways. But some of the major ones are if it's someone who's a victim of abuse at some point in their life, someone who has been oppressed within their life. One of the greatest populations of this would be the LGBTQ community. We're called to be loving to these brothers and sisters of ours, and we're called to accept them, not necessarily accept their lifestyle, but accept them as human beings. And I think that's a really important thing that I think a lot of Catholics miss out on, that we adhere so highly to church doctrine that we stop being human. And if there isn't heart within what your belief is, it's an ecclesiology that is void of anthropology, meaning you stopped being human and you're just following a recipe. And that's not a relationship with God. That's just following orders, and it's not healthy either. So you're a good candidate as well for a little bit of therapy. In all seriousness, and I make jokes, but I think it's really important. All of us have these core wounds. If you're going to confession on a pretty regular basis, unless you've been to the right priest, like you should be getting at that core wound. If you're bringing the same stuff in there every 2 to 3 weeks, there's something causing that. And it's not, it may become a habit at this point in the game, but the reality is that there's some wound that's there that needs to be addressed. And you can invite the love of God into that wound to get rid of that. And so it really takes a serious amount of prayer. Rather than focusing on the what you did, try to pray about why you did it. And maybe bring that to your confessor when you go to speak with them. Also, go to a confessor who's compassionate and loving. I think that's a really important thing. I got yelled at one time by a priest. This is pretty recently, too. I was shocked that I was able to evoke anger. But I went in, bless me, Father, for my sin, and I said something that I had said. It was a criticism of someone. And he just started yelling at me. And I was like, dude, I'm confessing to you. I know it was wrong. And then he's like, are you yelling at me? And I go, yeah, because I'm a priest too. Like, what are you doing? And he's like, sit down. I was like, no, I'm done. I'm out. Like, I don't need this. Nobody needs that kind of negativity in their life. But it was a real thing. I was like, no, you don't yell at people if they're confessing it. That means they're sorry for what they did. Contrition. It's the whole point of sitting in the box, man. And so I think that's a really important thing, that we're compassionate about individuals in sin. But also, I think it's very important for us to realize, or at least be compassionate about the fact that anyone who is gay or struggles with same-sex attraction or anything on that spectrum there, they're struggling enough. This wasn't a choice. That's like, I chose to be a ginger. No! No child chooses to be a redhead. Like, that is just... I didn't choose that, you know? They didn't choose their makeup and how they are attracted. I didn't choose to love women. That's not, it just wasn't, I don't know, did you guys get asked? Because I didn't. And so the reality is that we need to be compassionate to them in that, in their ability, and meet them and love them where they are and foster them, not hurt them. And I say that because anyone within that spectrum, anyone with LGBTQ, whatever, 2 to 3 times more likely to have some type of mental illness and the likelihood to attempt suicide. They are 2 to 3 times more likely. Okay, so our perpetual Catholic righteousness and that need to testify to the truth of the Catholic Church with some of our brothers and sisters, like we need to simmer it down a little bit and be a little bit more loving with that because we don't want to break their hearts and their whole spirit. Meet them where they are. No one's ever going to want to come to church if you hate them. And so remember that. It's a big, important thing. Now, once they come to us, then we work with that, right? That's what we do. But we have to love them enough to bring them to the church. Critical issues faced by multicultural communities. Less access to treatment. This is what everybody really struggles with in terms of why suicide becomes an issue in terms of mental health not being maintained. Less likely to receive treatment, poor quality of care. There's a stigma about going to therapy. I mean, like, seriously, I've witnessed this. You know, a couple will come because, let's say, the wife will bring her husband, you know, kicking and screaming to sit and talk to the priest. And I'm like,
you guys really could use some therapy. Like, this is, like, beyond prayer. I'm a big fan of Jesus.
But, like, you guys need someone with a little bit more firepower. Like, this, just for right now, then let's bring Jesus in. And I think Jesus should be a part of it the whole time, but usually one of them has not been to church in a very long time, and things are very broken at that point. And so it's one of those things. There's this idea, I say, go to therapy, and no, we don't go to therapy. That's for weak people. The strongest people I know go to therapy. It's because they've worked their stuff out, and they continue going to therapy. When I was in seminary, even when I wasn't struggling, I would still stop in every 6 months for a checkup just to make sure I wasn't losing my mind. If you've ever been to seminary or know a seminarian, you will know exactly what I'm talking about. You were surrounded by so much crazy that you're like, I need to make sure I'm not losing my mind too. And so you do the 6 month checkup, sometimes every three. And that's really important. Now, in terms of working through and discussing this, and really when we identify when somebody's really struggling, I can speak from experiences that I've had in ministry. I'm at the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. It is right downtown at the corner of Central and MLK. We have homeless that regularly are part of the audience, and of, you know, they're not coming to communion necessarily, but they're definitely listening when I'm preaching. And so I'm preaching to both the homeless as well as attorneys that are coming across the street for their lunchtime mass. The ministry there is amazing, and the ability to be there is it's very special, because I get such a different and diverse group of people that come walking in the doors, and they're all coming for Jesus. And so the ministry could be anything from, this morning I got a homeless guy that was trying to back himself across the street in his wheelchair, saved him from traffic and brought him to the sidewalk. And I also had to figure out how to fix the toilet that downstairs was exploding. So, that's kind of how that one goes. The blessing comes in those individuals, though, who just clearly are asking for help. They've hit rock bottom. They're struggling with abuse issues or substance abuse issues. They may be struggling with adultery within their own relationship. They don't know what to do. And, you know, they're not coming in there like they. You really go to a priest when everything has fallen apart. Like, no one calls the priest and it's like, I'm having a great day. Who wants to grab a beer? Anybody? Like, it does. That's not the calls that I get in the afternoon. It's a, everything is falling apart. Please fix this. And I could think of a young man who came in one day during Mass, and he was being really, really quiet, not responding during Mass, which, you know, it's not my, I really like people to participate in the Mass. That's one of the things that I love. But when you're clearly dialed out and you're just like introspective the entire time, like, you're struggling. And so I went and sat down next to him after Mass. I'm like, what's going on? And he just started bawling. And I was like, all right. I said, sounds like shit has hit the fan. We're all adults here. I said, things are bad. I could tell that he was shaking, so he hadn't had any drugs recently. This is a guy that who's wearing really nice clothes. He's looking about as dapper preppy as you are right now. But clearly going through withdrawals, struggling big time. And I'm like, let's talk it out. I won't talk about anything that happened beyond that, but starting off with confession was the main thing. We started with confession. I said, all right. I said, once this is done, we're not gonna talk about anything we talk about. It's a fresh slate. So whatever you wanna share with me, that's great. If you want a therapist, why don't you email and say, hey, Father, I'm looking for a therapist, and I'll send them your way. And that's how we do it. That's the warm handoff. I'm never going to talk about your confession again unless you talk about it. That's me. That's how I do it. But actually, that's how every priest should do it. They are sealed to confession. I don't know if they take it as seriously as that. I do. I want you to feel as though you're starting with a fresh slate. Now, if you come to me week after week with the same thing, and I have given you 8 million ways to try to fix that, and you still haven't gone to the therapist because you have an addiction, I may not be as sweet and loving as I should be. That's because you need a kick in the butt. You do not need a warm hug at that point in time. There's a struggle going on, and I'd love for you to work that out with a mental health professional, because Jesus isn't happy with you abusing the sacrament this way. If it's an addiction, that's an addiction. You're not falling into the state of sin. It's a sinful act, sure, but you're not culpable anymore. And that's where we come into this idea of culpability within the act of suicide. When someone is a believer, or someone actually has faith in God and they still choose to take their life, I would say
99% of the time, they're struggling with some degree of mental illness, and I'd be willing to say as close to 100 as I could possibly get. They're not in the right state of mind. They're desperate. Nothing's there. They have no control anymore. You only make this choice if there is nothing else that you have control over, and that is the singular choice that they have. I will take my life. It is the only thing that I can take. And that's a very sad thing, but to have that vantage of perspective, we can be far more compassionate. We can love our brothers and sisters who are clearly struggling, and we can do whatever it takes to love them back to wanting to be a part of life. Now, I've lost a number of friends over the years to addiction, suicide. They're always connected. I never wonder when someone overdoses if it was on purpose. I usually know it was. And that's the byproduct of doing ministry in urban areas. You get close to people, you take care of people, and then you realize that they couldn't be taken care of anymore. We also have to be aware, though, within this, that none of us are the Messiah, that Jesus Christ and God alone is our God, and that we are to respect the power of God and recognize the humility that we are not. And so you ask in as much help as you can get on these things. There are great resources that are out there. There are a million suicide hotlines in existence. I really think probably one of the best resources, or one of my favorite personal resources, would be coming from NAMI, the National Association for Mental Health. It's the mental, yeah. I'm going to keep up a link and have that for you guys. I'm going to actually share it, and that way everybody has access to that. The statistics on it are from like 2015, and I know it's a couple years old, but the reality is that of a sample population, these things don't necessarily change much. They're already staggeringly high. And so I'd rather open it up at this point to questions and kind of let you guys drill in the conversation as it goes forward, because I can state a lot of statistics to you guys, but I'd actually rather answer what you're curious about than give you statistics that you could Google yourself. Yeah. I personally deal with that within the context of confession is I make their penance be, you need to go talk to somebody about this. It's the only way that I can unburden my conscience on that one, and I think it's a fair penance. If you want to make this better, if you're confessing this, then actually that is the proper penance. You need to go fix this with somebody. But the context of it isn't that cut and dry. When I'm talking to them, I'm like, thank God you came here today. I'm glad God was with you and brought you here. I let them know how much they are loved. I let them know how glad I am that they're present. And then I look forward to meeting and talking to them again after they've talked to somebody. I even try to put some language in there to give them that hope and that date. And I think that's an important thing for the follow-up. I look forward to seeing you when we're starting to heal together. You know, that's kind of the language that I use. It's the best I got. But it's important to me. That's what I try to minister to people. I try to be the priest to somebody that I would have wanted myself. And so that it takes a little bit of prayer and really exploring your heart a little bit. What else we got?
So I've always heard that suicide is very prevalent in first world developed nations. Do you agree with that? And why do you think that is?
Well, here's the problem with that. Statistical analysis within other countries isn't as accurate in all cases. There are also, within some of the third world countries, they're actually changing of statistics, saying that less people die. Only crazy people do that, but it's kind of one of those things that it's harder to say. The pressure that exists in first world countries to be successful, this is something that very much does this. Japan, it's this drive to produce, or a drive to just rake in as much money. When you start becoming, here's a great analogy. My baby sister just had her own first baby. And this whole nursing thing is a great challenge. And so she's like, I need to not just feel like a milk machine. She goes, that's a very important thing.
And that statement resonated with me. It's like, yeah, none of us want to just feel like a machine, like just a cog in a wheel. This is why, like, believing in who you are, that you are unique and blessed in the eyes of God, and that if you are different, that is actually a beautiful thing. When we lose that anonymity, or when we lose that uniqueness and we just become just another cookie cutter in the world, what are you living for? You're just another cog in the wheel. There's somebody else that's there. It's that depersonalization that exists that's really tremendously damaging. It also exists in other countries, like in China, when life policies exist if someone dies on the job. And sometimes this doesn't exist this way anymore, but there was a long time, like at Foxconn and other of the Chinese companies that create the phones that we love so much, that people were killing themselves all the time because it was better for them to no longer live and that insurance money go to the family than for them to be working just like a slave every day. And so the gamut is there. Mental health is equally proportionate, though, unfortunately. Within first world countries, there are more opportunities for stigma that spawns it as well. The dysfunction within homes and things like that also can cause it. And the deinstitutionalization of the 1960s of mental health also caused a rampant breeding of individuals with mental health issues because they ended up on the streets. And homeless people still have sex too, so they had babies. And those babies ended up growing up. And so we have an entire generation of mentally unhealthy who went through the system, which just adds additional issues to that. So if you ever want to dig into that social justice realm, I'm happy to help you out. Yes?
What would you advise for people? I've known a number of people. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Okay, I'm just having to concentrate.
Okay, yes.
It still happens.
And then the person would try to commit suicide or threaten to commit suicide, and the other person would feel like, obligated.
Yeah, you're holding somebody hostage, basically,
yeah,
with your own life.
So what would you do in that situation?
We're past therapy at that point, right? And so at that point, actually, someone feels unsafe about their life, and there's actually a threat that's been made on one's own life, or you would actually involve the police at that point. The police aren't just there they're often there to break up crime, but they're also there to protect and prevent the loss of a life. The police actually view life the same way Catholics do, and so they're there to protect life. And so you would call the police because they have specialists who deal with things like that. I would advise them to talk to someone in the station rather than just call 911, because then it becomes a domestic dispute that gets dealt with very unprofessionally. You would want to go to the station and ask if you can talk to somebody about that at that point.
So would it be before they actually attempted?
Oh, yeah, we try to keep people alive. That's a good thing. Even if they're criminals, even if they're doing horrible things, we still want them alive. We are pro-life, yes. Yeah. The threat is a threat, and you treat it very real. When someone says, they start dabbling, I wonder what it's like. I mean, it doesn't have to be language that is as clear as, I have a plan to take my life. It would be like, I wonder what it'd be like if I wasn't here. I mean, I had an 11-year-old that I just talked to about this with the family. An 11-year-old. Where the hell does an 11-year-old come up with that? Like, I don't know the world that we live in. And so there was a I really took the God's plan kind of an idea in terms of, like, there is so much for you in this world in terms of the gifts that you've been given, and we're going to talk to a therapist, and we are doing these things, but, like, 11, and this is a very happy child. This isn't even showing any instances of mental illness at all, but she's thinking, what would life be like if I wasn't here? That's suicidal ideation, and so that has to be addressed. Yes? Great.
One thing I struggle with a lot is just determining the difference between spiritual warfare and mental illness. Can you give some insight on that from a priest perspective?
Yes. Okay. God bless you. Thank you for what you're doing. There's a lot going on there. Spiritual warfare, there are, okay,
I'm very divided in how I want to respond to this statement.
I understand.
I'm going to be very blunt, and I'm going to speak in hyperbole so you don't know actually how serious I am in this. How's that? There are individuals who blame a computer breaking down on spiritual warfare. Okay? The devil had nothing to do with your IBM or Mac. Like, it doesn't quite work like that. I'm not saying that it doesn't ever work like that, but I'm saying most often it does not work like that. There are certain individuals who they struggle with mental anguish on a regular basis. If you've been struggling with this for more than a couple of months, or even, I would say, multiple weeks at a time, while that type of dryness in prayer exists, you are comfortable with that because you have been dealing with the spiritual life for a long period of time at that point. Unless God has a different point planned for you, in which case he's probably sending an angel to you. So, like, you're working on a whole different scale of weird. And so, like, I would say most often it is a psychological issue that can be helped and aided. I don't like diminishing the role of prayer, but I think therapy and meds can also be incredibly important for very many people. I will say from experience, meds are not good for me. I am one of those people, I like to preach on the fly. I don't like to work off of a script. And my word retrieval on a variety of medications that I had tried made it very difficult for me to preach at this point. And so I basically just, I do double amount of therapy as opposed to that, just to keep myself, make sure that I'm not, you know, struggling too bad or anything else. The last few weeks have been a lovely time to be a priest, though, by the way. And so it might be a little worse right now than normal. But is that, did I answer your question?
Yeah. So on the topic of medication before, when you're talking about some of the causes of mental illness, just like generally people who genetically have clinical depression, not associated with any specific event in their life or oppression, do you feel like as a priest, either like specifically in the Catholic Church, there's a stigma against medication? Or do you find that like in your work, does it come up more and more, like a lot of gray area around?
I think, I do encounter circles of individuals who are very against medication across the board. And there are certain individuals that I'm like, you absolutely need to be on. If someone has bipolar, they absolutely need to be on medication for their own well-being as well as everyone involved in their life. Depending upon what the variance is of the highs and the lows, but I don't understand the stigma against medication. I do not think medication alone is a solution. I think we need a medication, and I think we need to be working through it at the same time. You cannot do one without the other. I've seen that happen, and that's how you end up with additional new behavioral disorders beginning, or that spawn from an original mental illness. And it snowballs, literally. It becomes a nightmare of mess. That's how people end up homeless, actually. Because so many people consider themselves Christians but aren't actually Christian in their true understanding of Christianity. So that's not one of those blanket statements that a check in a box statistically and sociologically can actually stand. Because there are probably 50% of people who consider themselves Christians who are actually racist bigots who don't like half the population. That is not Christian. So there is nothing guiding that lifestyle in any way. KKK considers themselves Christians, just to put that into perspective. I'm not being a jerk, I'm stating facts. When it comes down to, I don't have statistics in terms of the general teen population, but I do have some in terms of LGBTQ teens, because that actually is it's an ultra pressure cooker. I could say from experience, having worked in the high school last year at Our Lady of Mercy, 2 years ago, actually now, that there is a fair percentage of our youth population that is very confused by church teaching and how they feel on the inside. And they're having a very hard time reconciling that. I saw that as a very much a God moment, me getting put into that place, because I could be compassionate with those kids. And they'd never had a priest that had talked to them like that and said that God loves you as you are, but try to be good. You know, like that was, like that's the goal for all of us, is to be chaste, whether you're straight or gay. Like that's ultimately the goal. But, and so because of that, there's just that idea of identity, like there's something wrong with me. And that compiles the other things, plus the social pressure that's on that. So it really is just, it's a pressure cooker for teens that struggle with that. Because it begins at such a young age, such as 12, in terms of mental illness, that's where that tends to begin. The onset of mental illness tends to create a reality, a distortion in reality, or a perception distortion, in which case suicide can happen very, very young. More prevalent than suicide in that onset, though, tends to be like cutting and self-harm. It is so much more prevalent than you realize. Like it's everywhere. So, yeah, happy topics, huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you mentioned a little bit about social pressures, but can you talk a little bit about social media?
Gosh.
I know, and I know that it's definitely tied a little bit to a lot, actually.
I would say internet in general.
Internet in general.
Yeah. Because we have to also take in consideration Netflix. That's part of it. The Reasons Why show, right? Got two seasons all about suicide. Like, and you got to keep in mind, when you start, I had to prolong looking up stats for this talk, especially given the climate of the last 4 weeks, because you start reading this stuff for more than 30 minutes and you're just like, It's not healthy. Like, it doesn't take you to a good place. Like, I went and grabbed my Labradoodle, and I was like, we're going to go do a mile. Let's go. and that's how it went. I mean, because that's how it had to go. It makes it worse. Honestly, the internet is becoming the second biggest socialization within children. It's supposed to be, number one, being parents, family. Two would be school. Three would typically have traditionally been media, and now it's slipping into a second place. So they're learning more from what they're seeing on the internet than they are in school. That's super screwed up. I don't know which is worse, our schools or what. I don't know where do you start? That's why, in a really major way, at least in my own parish, I started changing catechesis at home. I'm making parents catechize their kids. We changed up Sunday school. They're coming and breaking down stuff once a month at the parish, but parents are being the primary teachers. That's the rite of baptism. May they be the first teachers. May they be the best teachers. It's one of the prayers. You know, I'm tired of doing your job. Teach your kids. I mean, I'm serious. Like, I get them for an hour a week. You are, like, annoyed by them all week long. Like, teach them about Jesus. They need Jesus. Do it. And the other reality was that parents didn't know anything about their faith either. And so this is a sly way of going, gotcha. And making them learn, too. It works. It's good. Yes?
So... say you have I'll be honest. I have a friend in Colorado that is struggling and has, like, when I was in college with him, we went to the police on him one time because we didn't know if something was going to happen.
Sure.
But I'm in Georgia and he's in Colorado, and he doesn't have a lot of a friend group there.
Mm-hmm.
What would you advise if I start hearing the what would this life be without? Whoa.
No, that's fair. My friends are in Chicago because I went to school in Chicago, right? And so the priest that I talked to and that opened up to me, like, I was their therapist. Like, 12 o'clock at night, they were knocking on my door. I was pouring scotch for them. I was a bartender before seminary. Before I was a banker. Anyway, and so what I did was I actually went up to Chicago and said, let's hang out with some of your friends.
I'd love to hang out with, you know, just at least one or two of your friends. And whatever sucker cared enough to show up to that dinner, that was the person that I had to talk with. I you know, when they went to go pee, I got some information, we traded it, we talked, we were good. And so that way, when I get scared, I can call them.
You gotta kind of be a sleuth about it. I hate to say it, but otherwise you make them all paranoid, and you know, you want to keep them at ease. Anxiety just induces further anguish. You don't want to bring that on them. They want to be able to talk to you. You want to keep that line of communication as wide open as possible. I will say there are certain people who are just like total Debbie Downers. And like, if you've known those people, the Eeyores in your life, love them. Just because they're depressed all the time doesn't mean they're necessarily suicidal. But keep an eye on them. Keep loving them. My temperament, I crack a lot of jokes and I have a pretty good sense of humor, but like, my mood level is about just south of melancholy about 90% of the time, with like brief interludes of joy. And it's just, that's just how I was wired. Like, that's how I've been since I was in seventh grade. And it's okay. I'm not like miserable all the time, but don't expect me to be happy about everything, you know? And that's okay. Like, I've come to realize that that's how my life is. And for a long time, I was like, well, that sucks. But you know what? It allows me to be more loving and more compassionate to people who struggle with this. And I would say there's probably been a good, in 5.5 years of priesthood, there's been about 20 people who I've been understanding enough to be able to get them back somewhere. Or me being able to talk about that. I love it when I preach someplace and some old lady comes to me and she's like, I haven't been to confession in 40 years. Will you hear it? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Let's do this. I mean, 40 years. There's some fun stuff that we're going to hear. I'm kidding. We'll keep recording.
What would you say, like, I guess in the context of, like,
can I be very honest with you? They can't be your friend when they're dead.
And if you don't do anything about it, that might happen. And so there's this reality that you have to be willing to jeopardize the friendship for the sake of the life. True sacrifice is never possible without, or true love is never possible without sacrifice. And in the terms of willing to love those people that we care about, and I'm talking about brotherly love in this case, but we are willing to sacrifice those things. Like, you have to. That happens in any cycle of life, though. You know, I mean, when someone's trying to end this, like, we want to end a chapter in this person's life and have a new beginning of a next. And so the truth is that you have to be willing to be the catalyst for that. That's not an easy thing to do. But that's why I would always say there are so many support lines that are out there that you don't have to do it alone. Like, you can get good counsel on how to go about doing this. And they'll tell you, you know, I want you to gather these kind of people. Do you know these kind of people? If you're like, no, I don't know these kind of people, they're like, okay, well, we're gonna get you in touch with someone who can help you with this. And so they'll involve some type of mental health care professional who you will accompany, and you'll do some type of intervention of some sorts. That's okay. Because the question you'll ask yourself for the rest of your life, if that person ends up dying, is going, why didn't I do that? Why didn't I say something? And I don't like, I'm not the flavor of priest who likes to motivate people with guilt, but I also don't want you to be stuck with guilt for the rest of your life. It's not fair to you. You'll beat yourself up about it.
So a lot of what's sort of the takeaway from a lot of the questions is play it safe.
Oh yeah, safe and sorry.
Do what's necessary to be safe and sorry. Where does that fall in line with the idea of somebody being overdiagnosed?
Well, this is why I say it's really a good idea to call a professional and talk to one of these hotlines, because they're going to ask you a series of different questions. Well, what did they say? Did they say it like this, or did they say it like this? And they'll either talk you out of the crazy tree, or they'll help you talk the other person out of the crazy tree.
Because hypersensitivity is also something worth discerning. We are a prayerful people as Catholics. Pray about it. Like, be aware of that feeling. I don't know if you guys know about consolation, desolation within your heart, but you know when something is life-giving and something you should do in terms of prayer. If you just let that be what sits in your prayer and you just kind of, you and God just chill out with that, you'll come to an understanding of what you're called to do. And it may be that you're called to do nothing. And God will say nothing if that's the case. But if it is what you ought to do, that prayer will go, oh yeah, I got to do it. It's that little Kantian voice. This is the categorical imperative. It has to happen. This is now. And you got to do it. God will whisper that like a tornado.
So I'm someone who's pretty open about my anxiety, but obviously there are people that are not, and about their mental health. And from my experience, a lot of when I experience it is when I'm actually by myself and not with other people. So the signs that we see in other people, that I think I've heard a lot of the stigma and the signs that look out for the signs. But what are the things that we can be asking people because we don't externally see things going on?
Be careful to probe. You know, you're not their therapist. I think that's an important thing. I mean, keep in mind, I said we respond when someone has told us something, rather than us feeling like we need to investigate or therapize somebody. Most people are not intuitive enough to really therapize somebody. They just can't do it. You can't pay attention. It's about your ego at that point. It's not about them. And that's why therapists and healthcare professionals spend a long time working their ego out to be able to help people. Because you wouldn't stick with it that long if it was about you, I think is ultimately what can happen. But listen to your heart. When you hear something that just seems off, you're going to respond to that. You'll know that. I think, from other people who have worked along this, would that be fair to say? Okay. You know. Just it's a kind of a trust your gut, and then if you start slightly doubting that, take that to prayer. Take it to prayer anyways. Take everything to prayer. Seriously. Like, do I really want to go pick up donuts this morning? Pray about it. You might just want to pour a cup of coffee. Yes?
Can you talk about how, in your faith life, how taking in the sacraments every day or just being a practicing Catholic, how that has helped your mental health?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I can tell when I don't go to Mass. So, to the point that I hike a lot. And so now I have like a little ultralight Mass kit now that I pack with me. And it's like, it's totally I actually welded down a chalice. So it's like seriously this big. And so I bring a little bottle of wine, a little bottle of water, and just a couple of hosts that I break up. And so I celebrate Mass every day on the trail when I'm there. I actually think I've got my stole's in my back pocket. That travels with me. It's still kind of gross, but I'm kind of hiker trash. So there's that. I noticed it when I was in seminary, when I would come home from a break and the last thing I wanted to do was see church people. When you're in seminary, you don't want to see everyone. It's so great that you're going to be a priest. So you're like, I don't want to talk about that right now. Like, I am here to breathe. I have fought to be a priest for the last 6 months. I am tired. Leave me alone. I love you. God bless you. Goodbye. And so I wouldn't go to daily Mass. I wouldn't do it because my home parish is, a lot of people love me there, and I'm very lucky to have that as my home parish, but it was exhausting to go to daily Mass because you have to go, I love seminary, and I don't like pretending at all. And so it was tough. I would realize about 3 or 4 days away from the Eucharist, and I'd be like, I need to go to Mass again. And so I'd go like across town and go to Mass. And that was good. And that actually was really healthy for me. Now I do a combination of, I do confession. I go once a month personally. I know some people are like the every other week kind of a guy. If I'm sinning enough that I need to go that much, I have no damn business being a priest. And so it's that reality that, like, I really need to try hard. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen more frequently than that. But the goal is, like, let's go a month without sinning. Like let's do our best to, like, go as long as we can. And so I think it changes you. You, Faith is a lot like gravity. Larger bodies attract. The closer you get to Christ, who is of the greatest gravitational pull in all existence, the closer you get, the more you're drawn, and you can't fall away from that. That's actually what keeps me a priest in the light of, like, priesthood has never been celebrated since I was ordained. Like, it's always been pedophilia jokes and all kinds of other garbage vitriol towards my profession. That's fine. We'll talk about it for eternity and see how it works out. But, like, for me, priesthood is it's really intended to be about bringing grace to people. And so I need as much grace as I possibly can have. The daily mass does that for me. And in that same light, I do not understand cranky priests, because you have so much exposure to Jesus, you have no business being cranky. Like none. You should be happy all the time, because we're always around Jesus, to the point that you can almost get like overly callous or overly comfortable about it. Like, you walk in front of a tabernacle like 20 times a Sunday, you know, and you're just like, all right, yeah, okay, yeah, I know you're there. All right, yeah, good job, Jesus. Like, you want to be very polite, and you want to be reverent, and then the same thing is, like, I've got stuff I've got to be moving right here. Like, the position isn't very convenient to what I'm trying to do right now. So it's that you don't want to be, not saying it's, I don't inconvenience myself for Jesus, but what I'm saying is, like, you're around it so much that you can become very callous about it. And so you have to be very aware of what's happening when I celebrate Mass. And so if you've ever been to one of my Masses, I put out a lot of energy when I'm celebrating Mass. I am a high energy person anyways. That's actually how I channel my anxiety. And so for me, it's about being very intentional in prayer, not getting callous about it. And in doing that, and allowing my mission, like the prayer and that output, that's how people receive grace. Like, I had a lady came to Mass on Monday, and I celebrated the Mass, and, you know, I gave a homily, and it was, you know, it was a Monday homily. Like, it's not like I was hitting it out of the park, but it was pretty good. And I could tell she was crying after communion, and I was like, oh no, like, I hope I didn't say something like offended her, or I hope I didn't say something wrong. Like, what did you say? What did you just preach about? You know, and like, I'm just like beating myself up. And so I go back to divest after Mass, and she walks in and she goes, you just celebrated the most beautiful Mass I've ever seen. She goes, I've been a Catholic for 68 years. She goes, my son hates the church. I can never get him to come along. And he actually enjoyed your Mass. And she's talking about her husband. And she gave me this big hug. And I was like, you know what? Like, that's why I do this. Because it's all you need is that singular encounter with God, and you yearn for it ever, forever, in everything. And so it's that gravitation. You got to encounter it, and then that's all you want. That's why you need to educate yourself. That's why you need to expose yourself to wider expressions of the faith itself. You know, I like working in black parishes personally. White parishes are boring to me. If you've ever been to, like, Lourdes, you understand exactly what I'm saying. Or if you've been to the Shrine, like, the music, it's a different kind of music. It's a different type of worship experience. And, like, I realized I needed that personally, too, in my own, like, expression of prayer. Like, I have to have high energy in the Mass. I love a good high liturgy Mass. The smells and bells, sure. I can rock the cassock. That's not a problem. But on the daily, on the weekly, when we need to energize ourselves, when we're living in a world with such very clear, I believe in a high energy Mass as opposed to a high Mass. And I want to be something that they're going to hold for the week. So, yeah.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah.
One thing, whenever therapists are assessing for suicidality, a lot of times that we like to find is if somebody has a strong spiritual background, that's a very strong resource that we can use to kind of help give them some just to tie back into like how you can help people with their faith and including, that's a big, I found that.
That's huge.
Honestly, when I find out that a client has a good spiritual background and has like, not just saying they're Christian, but truly like has a strong faith, I use that as a strength to kind of pull them away from the suicidality. So I can definitely attest to that.
That's good.
That the spirituality definitely plays a part in helping people struggling with suicidality.
It's an interesting core within the brain as far as where faith is held. My grandmother had Alzheimer's,
And it was funny. She wouldn't recognize anybody in the room, but when I would walk in with my collar on, she'd be like, "It's my grandson. He's going to be a priest." Couldn't remember my name still, but she knew I was going to be a priest. And she was getting to heaven soon, so I needed every prayer I could get. And so, we were sitting there, and I was sitting there with her, and she can't keep in the conversation. She can't do anything else. And, I get bored because she doesn't really talk anymore. So I'm like, all right, I might as well pray, right? Seminarian default. And so, I pull out the rosary, and I start praying. And I'm praying in a very low voice, and then all of a sudden I hear her praying along with me. She can't remember anything. She's got all of her prayers down. Why? Because it's stored in such a root part, a core of who we are, that despite the plaque that's up there, it doesn't affect that part of the brain. It's amazing. Faith is deep. And that's why I don't understand. When people leave the faith, it's like they didn't have it. Because I never want to leave the Eucharist. It's the greatest thing we have. It's the most special thing in existence. It's incredible. It's the best part of your day. And seriously, you have nothing you have to do in that very moment. It's you and your God, face to face. He's saying, I love you this much that I'm willing to die for you. And that love is so great that I come back to life. That's a gift. That's a gift. And if that doesn't get you going through your next week, you're not listening. I mean, it's something incredible. You're seeing a miracle. It's hard to see, but you're seeing a miracle. And you kind of take faith in that. So, what else you guys got? Yeah.
So, why is it the church was so strict in the past in regard to suicide?
Because I think it's a lack of understanding about mental health. It's like they just took their life. That's murder. And so that's a commandment. And so if you have broken one of the... suicide is of a grave nature. And so between that and intentionally doing it, it becomes a mortal sin. That's why mental health is such an important thing to take into consideration, because culpability is gone. While it is still of a grave nature, while people are still affected by the sin, the person who takes their life is not culpable for taking their life, in which case they no longer have sin. But that understanding of mental health, that's within the last 1970s later. And the Catholic Church, I don't know if you've noticed, we move at glacial speed. It's a big ship, and it's really hard to turn. And so even within changing of teaching, even with the Second Vatican Council, it took some parishes years within the United States to start truly adopting it. So you start changing something that people are emotionally attached to, like suicide. People get angry at the person who took their life. You can't be angry with that person. That person was struggling so much you can't even imagine. But people get angry. And that's why there's still a lot of people that want to hold on to that idea of vengeance. There are a lot of Catholics who really like their vengeance. They really like capital punishment for that reason. If you're pro-life, you can't be for capital punishment. Pope Francis just said you can't, there's that situation doesn't exist anymore where you can't keep someone locked away. But it's that same idea of we promote life in all cases, and so, I don't know, I'm rambling. Yes?
It's not really a change of teaching, though, is it? Isn't it just like kind of a clarification because that we've advanced in understanding mental health?
It's a combining of two different teachings, because we have had this understanding of culpability of sin since very early times. But to think of mental health as a factor that influences that wasn't taken into consideration. And that's why I said we're still struggling with bringing together psychology and theology, and that's why it's a nightmare. Yes, and then you.
So we went to a talk earlier this summer at another Christian church where they kind of dissected pieces of the Bible and how to do with what is God actually saying about mental health or anxiety. Are there any theologians or people in the church either now?
Well, what answers are you looking for? End game.
Well, I think that the topic that we've been talking about, it can't be an easy one to just combine two teachings of culpability and our understanding of psychology.
It's because psychology, mental illness, was never thought of as in existence at all. If someone was doing that, they were either possessed. Possession was often
to getting back to an original statement, possession was also often blamed for mental health issues. Any evaluation of mental health, though, before 1950 really is, like, with the exception of the big names like Jung and Freud and things like that, like, you really can't take much stock in it. And so it's really not worth rethinking. Either mental health is a factor in someone's suicide or it isn't. And the reality is that in almost all cases it is. Because for the person that's outside of faith, I had a friend who... I did my CP at Emory, and so I was mixed with other denominations of ministers, which was kind of fun. It was kind of super hippy-dippy. I anoint you with this water. I'm like, we do that too, but it's like for real. There was great banter between me and the Anglican too. She's like, we had to share compliments, and I was like, you guys do your sacraments so beautifully, because they do. Episcopalian, Anglican sacraments are beautifully done. And then she goes, yeah, but you think they're done validly too. And I go, well, I actually think ours are done validly. But it was one of those going back and forth. It's all about perception. It's all about, are you bringing people to Christ? Cool. That's great. People outside the realm of the Catholic faith, they have various, but it's pretty close in terms of life or death. When you're an atheist, suicide's like it's kind of like a either, hey, I want to live, or no, I don't want to live. If there's no afterlife, okay, cool. What's the point? So when you're done, or if you're a control freak, if you're a Hunter S. Thompson as well, that was his kind of thing. He took his own life. He was a reporter, 1960s, 70s, 80s. Tons of drugs. But like he was this person who very publicly took his life. It was one of the first celebrity, like very clearly, but he had recorded why he did it. And it was based on non-faith. And so the reality is if you don't believe in a God, well then you just believe you stop breathing when you stop breathing. And so if you have control over that, you have control. I don't know many true, like, legit atheists, if I'm being honest. I have a lot of people who profess to be atheists. They do things that contradict that statement. So it's an interesting thing. But if one doesn't have a belief system, it's very hard for you to... You can't put a value on life when there's nothing to live for it. From their mind. That's a tough thing. And so you have to kind of like side with service of one's fellow human and, you know, living for the environment and living to have a cause and something to, you know. It's hard when you're not dealing with faith to try to talk somebody into something. That's the hardest part. I mean, if you don't believe in God, I mean, just from the principle of the unmoved mover, like somebody had to start everything going. Even if you don't believe in all the nuts and bolts of Catholicism, like some deity just seems to be of common sense to me. But to just not acknowledge a God, like that's some conviction. And with that can come the conviction to take one's life as well. And so in those truest of senses, that happens often. Yeah. It was in the Catechism of Pope Pius X, so it was pretty official.
The Catechism is necessarily doctrine or dogma either. But
it's not dogma, but it is the teachings of the Catholic Church.
So what was the Church's official stance on suicide then? And
there is no dogma on suicide within the Catholic Church. I don't think you understand what dogma actually is. I went to class, an entire course to learn what dogma was about. So I can't give you like a short answer, but it is basically let me go back to my ecclesiology definition. It would be like an official doctrine of the church. Let me just look it up and I can give you it word for word rather than try to botch it.
But that's one that doesn't change, right?
Doctrine within the church does not change.
doctrine does not. Am I right on that? I'm pretty positive on that. Doctrine is very rarely established. That's the thing. There are very few things in terms of... Is Siri answering for us? But in terms of like what the church actually teaches, it's the commandments. It goes to the core law of faith itself. And that's why it's the fifth commandment, you shall not kill. And it's just a no-brainer. You break a commandment, you were done. And it was, any of the commandments are considered of a grave nature. It's not automatic if it's of the Big Ten, okay? And so, outside of that, it wouldn't have been until, I don't know if it was a revision within John Paul II's teaching on it. I don't really care when the tide turned on that one, if I'm going to be honest. The historical doesn't matter as much to me. But it really is about really being more compassionate and more loving regarding mental illness and taking that into consideration. And we do that also, keep in mind, if someone calls and they need an exorcism, we make them go do a psychological exam first. Absolutely. One, maybe two. And then we establish with a team of those who go forth to address that in that way. And sorry, I'm struggling with retrieval of words when I went off topic, but yeah. Sure. Oh, the rabbit hole is so deep. Like, you just realize how much you don't know the more you learn.
Yeah,
no, it's true. So, it's ultimately, who's the judge? It's God. I mean, all this, keep in mind, all of this is always speculation. I mean, there might be someone who was like, they didn't have any mental illness, and you just didn't know what it was, or they had a tumor that caused compulsive behavior. There was no mental illness. There was a physical ailment. There are tons of things that happen with the thyroid in terms of moods, like switching all together. There's so many different factors, and this is the great struggle of much of Catholicism today. It's not all of Catholicism, but it's many. There's a generation of it. They want to be told exactly what they're supposed to believe. You are so smart. Like, we have reason. Figure it out if it is a sin or not. Evaluate it, because there isn't a... Otherwise, we'd have these giant books, and it's like, the great Catholic book of how to live, and you'd follow that book exactly. But that doesn't make you grow as a human being if you're not flexing those muscles of decisiveness and discernment. It needs to be a spiritual and emotional endeavor. And so you need to be praying more. That's how you grow as a human being. When you want somebody to just tell you how to live, like, you are the human equivalent of a soft piece of software. You're just following the commands of someone else without exercising your own free will. I don't know that that actually makes God smile that you're trying to grow rather than just following all the rules. He wants you to live, and that means that you grow, and that's an Aristotelian thing. A tree glorifies God by its branches growing out. We as humanity, in our growth and our ability to love our brothers and sisters, that's how we glorify our God. And so it's a very important thing. Yes?
So in reference towards, like, you mentioned, like, Eeyore-type people in our lives.
Say that again?
In reference to, like, Eeyore-type people in
yes.
our lives, if there's someone who constantly is just on this forever wheel and they actually receive therapy and they are on medication and they're doing everything they can,
cultivating a language of gratitude with that individual. So let's say someone came and they sat down next to me and they said, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 4 weeks since my last confession. Here it is." And, you know, depending upon piety level, there'll be some other thing thrown in there before then or not. And they start talking about, "Well, you know, I'm angry at everybody all the time, and I'm shooting the bird at everybody on the way to work, and I'm yelling at my wife, or I'm yelling at my husband, and I'm losing my temper with my kids," and so I'll just kind of like listen to them for a couple more minutes, and it's solemn, but it's really, they're just giving me a litany of everyone who they've like assaulted in the last 48 hours that compelled them to come to seminary, or to confession, rather. Same difference. Anyway, and so you sit there and you listen, and I go, I've got a great penance for you. I want you to go to Target or whatever your favorite store is. I want you to pick up 25 thank you cards. And I want you to prayerfully write 25 thank you cards. They need to go one to each different person. Do not write two to one person. I want you to start cultivating language of gratitude. And someone comes back to me, and I said, I really want you to come in and check in with me. I wouldn't mind you letting me know, by the way, but thank you card. There's your freebie. and it's amazing, the response that I get, because they started, 25 thank you cards take some time. This is why, like, you know, recent graduates around the nation, like, never write their thank you cards, because it sucks. But, like, you really are supposed to do it, and what it does, it makes you better. It makes you cultivate that language of gratitude, that ability to recognize the things that we're thankful for in the world. That's how you turn out to be a good person and a happy person. It's not going to make you Pollyanna. I mean, like, it's not a personality transplant. But it definitely helps you be more aware of the things that you're thankful for. And it's little life hacks like that, you know, that you're like, oh, I really like this gratitude thing. Cool. Start journaling. Write one thing a day that you're grateful for. Done. That way you don't lose the language. You just keep working on it. That's it. Cool. Y'all have been awesome. Thank you very much. Thank you.